You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hello, this is Tim Rice. Welcome to episode 44 of my podcast, Get Onto My Cloud. I think the question I've been asked most often when people realize that I've made a living by writing words for songs is, which comes first? The words or the music? With most theatrical songwriting partnerships, the music tends to come first, perhaps inspired by a title, but that way round, the composer is allowed to flow freely, which is good, forcing the lyricist to be concise, which is also good. But there have been striking examples of brilliance emerging from the words being first out of the blocks. W.S. Gilbert and Oscar Hammerstein, to name but two. I haven't a clue what the order of play is for those rare birds like Cole Porter, who are masters of both words and music for the theatre. The first time I ventured into songwriting, I wrote both words and tune. I think I instinctively knew that my lyrics were better than my melodies, but I enjoyed making the most of my 3.5 chords on the guitar and as many as 5 on the piano, to impart a few simple tunes to accompany my words of teenage angst, which, by and large, at least rhymed. Almost by mistake, one of my songs was actually recorded by a third party and released on a 7-inch, 45 RPM gramophone record. Those terms are totally obsolete today, but back in 1965, it was quite something to have your name on the label of a commercially released pop single, which, for generations X, Y, and Z, and or millennials, that was a round, flat, plastic object, roughly 17.78 centimetres in diameter, with a hole in the middle, which, when placed around a spindle on a gramophone turntable and requested to revolve at 45 revolutions per minute, enabled a piece of pre-recorded music to be heard with crystal clarity when a needle was simultaneously and sometimes even automatically placed into the grooves of the revolving platter. Technically, of course, there was only one groove on each side of the disc. Oh, never mind. The point is, on the strength of this one recording, which was featured in the very first Get Onto My Cloud podcast, I considered myself a songwriter, even though the song in question was a flop. However, it did eventually lead me to another songwriter, a 17-year-old named Andrew Lloyd Webber. And although he hadn't actually had a record released of any of his songs when I met him, he'd written several musicals, and the extracts he played me showed me that he was pretty good. His music was far more sophisticated and original than my 3-chord efforts. I was delighted when he suggested we work together on a show of his that needed new words, with our roles clearly defined. He would write the music, and I would write the words. The first show we wrote together, way before Joseph, was a musical, for which Andrew had already written most of the score. I'm never quite sure whether the term musical score includes words, if there are any, but generally it seems to mean the music alone. That first show we worked on was called The Likes of Us, and told the story of the Victorian philanthropist Dr. Thomas Barnardo. As the music was virtually all written, clearly in this case it had to precede the words, which I hastened to provide as speedily as possible to impress this teenage musical maestro, who was clearly heading for great things. So my first experience of songwriting with another was music before lyrics. When writing a musical, I've since realized that the most important thing to get right before any songs are actually created is the story, the plot. On reflection, I don't think the Dr. Barnardo story was very well told by us in The Likes of Us. But at the time, I was so convinced of the merit of the tunes, I gave the story very scant consideration. Obviously, I had to know the situation in which each song was placed, who was singing it and why, and what we wanted the finished song to achieve, character or plot-wise. But as far as the overall thrust of the story went, I was lamentably unconcerned. Being new to the game, and new to Andrew, I do not recall making any suggestions to him about the music, which anyway I thought was absolutely marvellous. I assumed every melody he gave me was just what the show needed, and I did my best to make every syllable fit. By and large, they did. But because the overall construction was not right, the show never got beyond demo recordings. However, it did show us, and indeed our friends and families, that we had the potential to achieve something as songwriters, albeit not with Dr. Bernardo. Once we were established, thanks to Joseph and Jesus Christ Superstar, knew each other extremely well, and had had the odd argument, which is only to be expected in any long-term relationship, we would each express views about the other's contribution, forcefully at times, but perhaps, by and large, I hope, tactfully. Generally speaking, if Andrew objected strongly to a lyric, I would at least contemplate a change, and if I was sometimes critical of a melody or, more often, of an orchestral arrangement, my thoughts sometimes made Andrew pause. But our roles were still clearly defined and we remained a team. The working format was still the same, except we were by then well aware that we had to get the story and overall structure of each musical into good shape before actually embarking upon writing any scenes or songs. Thus, story, music, words. Nearly all of the songs from The Likes of Us were written in 1965 and 1966, but there was one number which did not see the light of day in finished form until 2005. We decided that year to present a private production of our first ever show to an invited audience at Andrew's annual Sidmonton Festival, and a very strong cast was assembled to deliver it. Unlike our subsequent works such as Joseph, Superstar and Evita, which were all sung through operatically, The Likes of Us was a more conventional piece of musical theatre, in that chat was scheduled to take place between each song. As we'd never really settled on the dialogue for the non-musical bits, I wrote a narrative linking the numbers and making what sense of the plot I could. Stephen Fry accepted our invitation to act as master of ceremonies for the performance and added numerous samples of wit and wisdom to the yarn, often dipping into the real-life tale of the two young musical writers. Andrew reminded me, I think accurately, that there was one tune he'd written for the show to which I'd never added a lyric, a song for Bernardo's girlfriend and eventual wife, Siri, who, in true Sound of Music mode, wonders in which direction her life is going. I've often been accused, and often quite rightly, of being late to produce my lyrics, missing deadlines. But I think taking 39 years to deliver words in 2005 that I should have handed in 1966 is my most sluggish performance to date. But in the end, I rather liked the result. I had to imagine how I would have tackled the lyrics had I actually got round to it at the time, as a lyricist new to the game and very influenced, as we both were, by what was big at the time, The Sound of Music, of course, and the works of the great Lionel Bart. I called the song, This Is My Time, and I think both words and music are true to that era just before rock broke into theatre, helped no end by a lovely vocal from Sally Ann Triplett.
This is my time in the sun, my springtime. Look at me bright and gay. I should be wild and fancy free, never afraid to say. This is my time, it's my wondrous April, followed by perfect May. I'll fall in love 100 times. I shall refuse to believe in the blues today. Am I wrong when I feel that my bravest of dreams will come true? Am I wise to reveal all that I'm longing to do? Oh, this is my time, as it is for those whose tale has not yet been told. Those who, like me, are optimists. Those who have got a heart that will not grow old. Mm-hmm. that my bravest of dreams will come true? Am I wise to reveal all I'm determined to do? Oh, this is my time, but it's not forever. One day I know I'll be sharing my time and happiness, memories too, with somebody who loves me. Sharing my time with somebody.
With just a few exceptions, such as the argument between the young Eva Duarte and Agustin Magaldi in Evita, and some of the lines in Jesus Christ Superstar, but very little, all the songs and scenes Andrew and I wrote together were music before lyrics, and it worked very well that way. Some of Andrew's tunes were so strong without words, it seemed a pity to risk spoiling them with a lyric. For example, the melodies of Don't Cry for Me, Argentina, Gethsemane, and Memory. That last one, not one of my lyrics. But in the end, as those examples show, an inspired tune will usually bring out the best in a words man. And vice versa. It can work just as well the other way round, as I discovered when I teamed up with Elton John. I first realised that Bernie Taupin's wonderful lyrics were written before Elton's majestic melodies, when Elton was going through a brief period of writing with other lyricists, and accepted an offering of mine entitled The Legal Boys, which appeared on his Jump Up album in 1983 without setting the world alight. That one, by the way, is featured in Get Onto My Cloud podcast number 3. So when I received the wonderful news that he'd agreed to work with me on Disney's The Lion King, the animated feature movie, one of the first things I asked him was whether he had any great melodies lying around which might fit The Lion King's story. Elton said, no. I thought about asking him if he had any average melodies lying around which might work for The Lion King, as even a mediocre Elton melody would probably have been better than a good one by almost anybody else. But before I could put that tactless question to him, he told me categorically that he never wrote anything without a lyric in front of him. This was good news in that it gave me more freedom as far as rhyming patterns, verse structure, and story considerations were concerned, but bad news in that I had no excuse not to get off my arse and write a lyric, unable to say I was waiting for a decent tune before I could do any work. As it turned out, getting the words right first worked very well for the movie, as storylines were constantly being changed, characters written in and out of the tale, musical scenes and dialogue scenes continually being swapped around, all these decisions being made at script meetings, usually at Disney's headquarters in Los Angeles at 7 a.m, at which my presence was crucial. The lyrics, in effect, being part of the script. Thus, every time I sent a lyric to Elton, there was a pretty good chance it would end up in the picture. As it turned out, we did write quite a few songs that ultimately failed to make the cut, but far fewer than would have been the case if the tune had come first. And of course, Elton's busy touring and recording schedule anyway made it impossible for him to come to more than a very few Lion King meetings. Thus, the formula of story, words, music worked very well, as they have done throughout Elton's illustrious career with Bernie. When writing words with no tune to hand, my first task, after noting which character was singing and what the point of the song was to establish a rhyming pattern and overall structure for the song. In writing each line, I could use as many words or syllables as I liked, but I only really had that freedom for the first verse, as subsequent verses would have to fit the same pattern. If I'd written, say, what I thought was a clever but fairly easily obtained triple rhyme in verse 1, I had to find another one in verse 2, and 3, and 4, which might not be so simple. Once the lyric was finished, and having had the director's and scriptwriter's approval, I sent it off to the great man, in those days by fax. A couple of days later, no more, a cassette appeared with Elton's unmistakable piano and vocals giving life and melody to my labours. While waiting for these exciting moments, I would often sing these brand new lyrics to a very simple tune of my own, not dissimilar to the ones I was writing in 1965 when I saw myself as the new Donovan. It also helped to make sure that the words were singable, as sometimes a line that looks okay on paper can be difficult for even a great singer to interpret clearly. I would get rather attached to some of these tunes, and when first playing Elton's cassette would find the first two or three bars rather at odds with what I expected. However, any ludicrous thoughts that my tune had any merit at all compared with his disappeared pretty pronto by about bar four, and by the end of the demo, it was clear the film was going to be blessed with yet another great Elton melody. I did actually witness one of the most famous songs from The Lion King, perhaps the most famous, being written. We'd had a couple of goes with an opening number for the movie, which had to be dramatic, make a big impact. I knew that the scene would feature all the animals of East Africa, but my first attempt at the lyric, which mentioned most of them, was too light-hearted, came out a bit like a shopping list. In response, Elton provided a good and sympathetic tune, but like my lyric, not what the directors, Roger Allers and Rob Minkoff, felt was right for the scene. They were much happier with my second bash at the lyric. So I called Elton to find out where to send the words, but as for once we were both in London, he said he'd record the demo in a couple of days' time, and not to bother to send it now, just bring it along to the studio. When I arrived, just after lunch at Air London Studios on Oxford Circus, Elton had set up his keyboards with one of the regular members of his touring band, Guy Babylon, also a master of the keys. Throughout the session, they were continually experimenting with rhythms to accompany the hitherto unheard words, and unheard melody for that matter. I handed over the manuscript, and he began singing the words over and over. Every pass contained a slight alteration or sophistication, and made an exciting, powerful, anthemic tune stronger each time round. After a while, Elton wondered if it were possible to have one more line. The chorus of the song was already a compelling, muscular crescendo building on the faith, hope, and love lines. I hadn't expected this. I'd rather hoped that my job was done. But from somewhere came up with the phrase, "On the path unwinding," which fitted perfectly just before the climax of the chorus. That one extra line really made a difference, so I was relieved I turned up at the session. After no more than an hour, or perhaps an hour and a half at most, Elton had a terrific demo of what sounded to me like a perfect opener for The Lion King, and a hit. The song he'd just written was, of course, Circle of Life. It was an astounding experience to be present at the creation from a standing start of a piece of music which has resonated around the world, thanks, of course, to the Disney team behind the movie, Rob, Roger, and producer Don Hahn, and to Hans Zimmer and Lebo M., who orchestrated and established Elton's genius in an African context, while Elton's own single release of the song stormed the charts and radio stations. Thus, story, words, music. Here is Circle of Life, as performed by the original Broadway cast in 1997. The lead vocalist, the formidable Tsidi Leloka, and the company Ensemble.
Ingonyama ningwe na mabala, ingonyama ningwe na mabala, ingonyama ningwe na mabala.
the sun. There is more to see than can ever be seen, or to do than can ever be done. There is far too much to take in here, more to find than can ever be found. But the sun rolling high through the sapphire sky keeps great and small on the endless round. It's a circle of love, and it moves us on through the circle, through faith and love, till we find our place on the path that's winding in the circle, the circle of life.
Episode 44 of my podcast, Get Onto My Cloud, written and presented by me, Tim Rice, and produced by, who else, Peter Holtz.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the SUFS. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, SUFS celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat, and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Suffs has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.